Hi, today is January 17th, 2021, and this is Mobile News Podcast 347. I'm Todd Ogasawara, my good friend John Westfall. We're back after 1 week hiatus. Last week was CES 2021, which is all virtual, so we didn't miss not going because nobody went. Yep. Have you ever been to CES, John? I have never been to CES.
No, I've never been to CES, so I have always seen it from afar and been slightly envious and jealous of those that did go, but yeah. This year we were all on equal footing.
Yep, yep. And I will say that I am in the same boat, never been to CES. I said for years I'm going to go one of these days, never did. I used to go to Comdex and NetWorld Interop in Vegas, and I'm not a real fan of Vegas. I've never been to Vegas on a personal trip in my life. I've been there like, I don't know, a dozen times, 15 times, but never, always because of a conference. But anyway, I've always wanted to go to CES also. Okay, but before we get started, a couple of things. First, to note that things that are announced, products, services that are, I guess not so much services, products that are announced at CES are always future looking. Very rarely is there something actually available, so anything we talk about, you might have to wait for a couple of months at best.
And more than a few times, it may never show up.
Yeah, there are a number of announcements that are concept announcements. So, you know, they're not even promising anything. They're just saying, hey, look, this is kind of, you know, fun and like, what you call it? Like the flying car that I think GM, might have been GM, showed. You know, it doesn't get around the whole need for air traffic control and pilot's license, all kinds of stuff you need to in addition to actual car. But anyway, so there's that. Three things I wanted to mention and get John's reaction to. Well, the first one he doesn't care about. And that I booted up my MacBook Pro, which I only use once a week to record these podcasts because I use the new MacBook Air the rest of the time. And there is a 12-gigabyte Mac OS Big Sur waiting for me, and I'm still holding off and updating because I want to make sure my audio software works with Big Sur before making the update. The other interesting thing I noticed, John, I don't know if you noticed it, maybe I've just been doing it wrong the whole time. Mac OS, which is now one word, MacOS, the M is lowercase. I've been typing it uppercase all these years.
Yeah, it's weird how they do style Mac OS, and yeah. I believe it's to keep it styled the same as iOS and iPad OS gets a little P, but that's special for it. Yeah. But yeah, and Watch OS is lowercase styled, so these stylings are difficult to keep straight because MacBook Pro and, you know, Mac is still capitalized.
Right.
So who knows?
Right. That said, at least Apple's branding is a lot easier to understand than Microsoft's, and almost always a lot shorter. You know, I think we remember the various machinations of Windows Mobile that confused the heck out of everybody, even those of us who specialized in it.
Yes.
Okay. The next.
Yeah. Well, and for a while there, when we were transitioning, and it was, Windows Mobile, formerly Pocket PC, formerly Windows CE, but still kind of Windows CE, depending on what device you're running, and maybe it's still Pocket PC. Not quite sure. And smartphone OS as well.
And there was also something like a usual blank edition, you know, something edition.
Yes.
Right. Okay. The next thing I wanted to get your reaction on is I put a link in, I just saw it before we started the podcast on ZDNet. There's an article that says the Trend Micro, you know, the security company, surveyed a bunch of, I assume CISOs, you know, cybersecurity information type officers. And 40% or something like that said they expect to be replaced, they, humans, expect to be replaced in cybersecurity roles by AI by 2030, which is not that far from now. And, you know, as an educator of college-age people, I wonder what you would tell them. Because a lot of people are interested in cybersecurity.
You know, it's interesting to me what you see in all of IT. And there's two things here that I think are interesting. First, So if the AI replaces the people defending against threats, how long until the AI replaces the people who are creating the threats?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just AIs battling each other, and then one AI figures out how to reprogram the other AI,
yeah.
in which case, and then vice versa. So it's going to be interesting to watch.
Right, and there are the two books thing, about though, that, by the way. You know, there's Forb and the Colossus Project. Don't know if you've ever read that book or saw the movie, which wasn't bad, kind of a grade B 1960s movie. And then, of course, there's Terminator. mm-hmm. You know, but anyway, sorry, John, I interrupted.
But
you.
I think the other thing that's very interesting to consider from an educational perspective is we've seen IT go from what we would sort of think of as an IT renaissance professional, where you could do anything. You know,
yeah.
you've got hired into a company and you could, you know, be working in the security area for a while, and then you might switch over to leading a programming team, and then
right.
you might switch over to operations or all of those things. And that was sort of the way IT guys were painted for a long time.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really until the last 10, 15 years that we saw people hyper-specialize. And all of a sudden, you know, you had the director of IT security, but he didn't know how to reinstall Windows on his own PC, or a programmer that had no idea what a firewall even was and why you'd even have to care about it. And I think we sort of shot ourselves in the foot when we went to this specialized mode, because we basically said you can make your career out of something like IT security, when in fact IT security might fold into AI. And if you never had any experience with AI, well, now you're out of luck. And if you do have, you know, if you are into programming and you only looked at one kind of programming, you might find yourself out of luck if that gets folded into something else.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to watch. I always maintain that it's better to have a broad set of skills than an extremely narrow set of skills in any industry that is rapidly evolving. And IT definitely fits that bill.
That's a good point. And it's funny you mentioned that, because I was just thinking, you know, in my father's day, people who drove cars also knew how to fix them. I mean, that was just,
yeah.
it was a non-overlapping set. It was just, you know, or completely overlapping, depending on who wanted to look at it. If you could drive, you could fix your car. It was just sort of, that's the way it was. And I remember, I think I was in my 30s maybe at the time, and I started noticing a lot of young software developers had never touched assembly language, which is a norm now, you know. That's
mm-hmm.
But back then it was like, well, if you've never programmed in assembly, how do you even know how a computer works? You know, it's kind of
mm-hmm.
my take on it, which of course now is, you know, not the case, I think. But it's interesting how we evolve. And you make a really good point that really these folks maybe should start looking to AI, because somebody's got to write the AI that, you know, protects us
yeah.
all. So,
well, I, you know, you talk about people that don't know from, you know, soup to nuts, that phrase, you know, how to do everything they need to do. I see
yeah.
that a lot in psychology, where 20 years ago, if you were a psychologist running anything on a computer or on an electronic relay, you knew everything about that programming. You knew, you know, and I had colleagues that stockpiled Apple IIs and stockpiled all the hardware they could ever need for the rest of their career, because they knew how it all worked and they could get it to work just fine. And now when I talk with younger colleagues of mine about running an online experiment or running,
yeah.
you know, building small electronics projects, I get a lot of, well, I'll just hire a student that can do that for me, or I will, you know, I'll buy this big expensive software product that does that.
And right.
I'll tell them, well, you know, you're using like 1% of that software product, and you spent, you know, thousands of dollars for something that you really could do yourself. And
yeah,
it seems like it's a complete shift in mindset, where it's no longer do I have to know all the steps from start to finish.
Yeah, yeah, that's really interesting. And we should have a longer discussion about that, because, you know, as an old guy, I've seen the evolution or the development of this. Oh, I think. Oh, I thought I lost you for a minute
yeah.
there, John.
Yeah, you blipped for a second.
Yeah, okay. I wonder if I'm having network problems. I mentioned to John that, you know, I can't see the access point in my home that I normally use. I'm on the backup access point, and I don't even see the primary. And they're the same box. So I'm going to have to reboot my router after we finish this. Nor do I see the backup to the backup. So anyway, which is a different box. So I got to go take a look upstairs. And we're also expecting a possible storm today, so things might get interesting. And the last thing I wanted to note is that I was at one of the two centers for local technology for me, one being Costco, and I was at Sam's Club yesterday. Where pretty much, I pretty much buy all my hardware locally. All my local hardware purchases are made from one of those two places usually. And yesterday I found the Y-Things, and I think you're probably familiar with Y-Things, John. They make a whole lot of health-related IoT stuff. I found the Y-Things temporal thermometer. And it's a smart one, so it's got Bluetooth, and you can talk to your iPhone or Android and keep a log of your temperature. And, I know you're kind of a biometrics freak also. And so I thought you'd find it interesting. The interesting thing was I'd been looking at it on Amazon, but on Amazon it's like $100, $99. And at Sam's Club, it was $89, so $10 savings. I got to pay our excise tax, which is what some other states kind of think of as sales tax, but I had to pay our excise tax on either one, so saved a couple of bucks. And I'm not a proud owner of a Not a proud owner of a Bluetooth thermometer, so I'm pretty excited by that.
That does sound interesting. I have that on my further list eventually of Internet of Things, smart things to buy. But right now I've kind of held off. But I'll be curious to hear your reaction to it.
I will. I'll try it out. The other thing, it's not on our list, but I just wanted to mention to you because it irritates my wife to no end, and I got a quieter one this week. I've been trying. I think I mentioned last week. I've been trying to rehabilitate my left wrist so I can play guitar again, and so I bought this. I won't call it off brand, but it's probably not the best known brand of power balls or whatever they're called, spinners. There's various names that basically are gyroscopic balls that rotate thousands of times per minute. And it puts pressure on your wrist and forearm, and I think a little bit upper arm. Anyway, and it's supposed to help you rehabilitate your wrist. I think something fell behind you. But in any case. So I bought one, and it's really great. I love it. It lights up and blinks in the dark and all of that. But it's really noisy, and it's driving my wife nuts. So anyway, I spent a little bit more money. And I bought the brand, I guess it's better known, NSD. And this one doesn't really light up, but which is kind of disappointing. But it does have an LED on the bottom that's powered by the actual gyroscopic spinning. So there's no battery that you install or replace or recharge. And it's way quieter, way quieter. And it shows you how many RPM you've got the ball spinning at any given time. So there's also a Bluetooth version, which I have not bought, which will log it on your phone. But speaking of Internet of Things and health-related items, they're really
fun. It just
fun.
Sort of reminds me of if you don't record it, did you really do it?
Exactly.
I had a friend who told me that her Apple Watch didn't pick up her exercise, and I said, "Well, then that's worthless. why even exercise if your Apple Watch doesn't record it and give you credit for it?
Right.
What's the point? This personal wellness, that's not fun.
Yeah,
you should be getting badges and recognition from other people, and this is just
yeah."
Yeah, that's the one thing, manufacturers of health-related things, if you don't make a product that lets us... And it's interesting because I did notice this a couple months ago. So the food logging product that I use, MyFitnessPal, which is a well-known app on iOS and Android, I have a streak going with MyFitnessPal because every day I logged in, to record my food, today included. So if I open up the app, and I go to the streak, I'm at a 967-day streak right now.
Wow.
And when I first started logging my calories back in 2011 or 2010, whatever year that was, I had started using MyFitnessPal, and I was using it religiously every day. And then, as time went on, I would start using it later in the day, And one day, it was after midnight, and I logged all my food from the previous day. I hadn't eaten much, so I just went in and added all of that in. Well, it broke my streak because I had not logged in that day.
Oh.
And I was so angry with the software for breaking my 100 or 150 day streak that I just stopped using it.
Wow, that's really vengeance.
Cut off my nose to spite my face. And I just stopped completely using it. And then a few years later, I started using it again. And I noticed in the last, year or two, somewhere in their support documents, I was reading, and someone said, "What do I do if my streak gets broken by accident? The software doesn't log in or whatever." Right. And they now just have a web page that you go to, and you can literally set your streak to whatever you want. They've decided, we're not going to let this be a demotivational thing. So if you dig around and you want to reset your streak to 700 and whatever days, it'll just take your word for it, which I guess the software should just take your word for it. You are the user of it. But it cracked me up, and I was sure that they had some metrics data that showed that the day after someone broke a streak, they just stopped cold turkey. It was just like,
I'm not doing it anymore. That's interesting. At some point I will log into my Fitbit site, because the app doesn't actually keep track of, I don't think it keeps track of everything, but people ask me, "Dude, why do you wear two watches?" I have an Apple Watch on my left wrist, and I have a Fitbit Charge 4 on my right wrist. And the answer is because, I really like the Apple Watch. It does a whole heck of a lot of things I like. But more importantly, the reason I still have a Fitbit, because the Apple Watch really does do everything a Fitbit does. Except for one thing. It doesn't have my data from 2010.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Here's the question. Can you take the Fitbit off of its band and put it on the underside of your wrist on your Apple Watch?
Then
you could have one watch that would
rule them all. Actually, you can. The Charge 4 is designed to work off the band. The band is not functional, so to speak, and it doesn't add anything except hold it on your wrist. So you can, in fact, do that. I'm not sure how the magnet. I wear a magnetic Apple Watch band, so I'm not quite sure if that would affect it or not. But it's an interesting point. One thing that would be against that is that one of the reasons I wear a Fitbit is because I also use it to track sleep, because a Fitbit doesn't have to be charged as often as the watch. And which reminds me, I should charge it now while we're talking, and not walking. So if I did that and I had to charge my watch, I'd have to take it off and it wouldn't track my sleep. Since I don't know about you, John, but my watch, especially after the last couple updates, is not really good at maintaining its charge. It's pretty low at the end of the day. End of the day for me is like 10:30.
I started wearing my watch to bed at night. I've started getting in the habit of an hour to an hour and a half before bed, I charge my watch. And so the watch gets charged at that time of day, and then it's ready for the next 24 hours. But yeah, I wouldn't go more than 24 hours. This is also reminding me of when I last went to Walt Disney World. The smart bands or the magic bands that Disney uses for things like park attendance tickets and all that. I actually found a 3D printed little holder for them that clipped onto my Apple Watch band. So that was another one of those try to have one band that rules it all compromises in a sense. And that worked pretty well. I used that more than I actually wore one of the bands, because it was nice just to have one thing on my wrist.
Okay. Anyway, so that was a little divergence, but it was good because it reminded me to charge my Charge 4, which is down to 43%. Of power. I don't like it to get much further below that. The next thing is, CES is so future looking. I kind of look at it like a conspiracy theory. It's sort of interesting, but doesn't have immediate impact on me, or even real impact on me, I guess I should say. And so I often don't pay attention to CES, but this year there are two things that caught my attention. Well, there were more than that, but these two things caught my attention because they're apparently going to be available in the near future, as in this year. The first one is actually an update of a genre, I guess, of notebooks that has been out for a couple of years now. And that's a specific one here is the Asus ZenBook Duo, which has, you know, this is the updated model that's been out for a couple of years. And the cool thing about it is it has a second LCD screen just above the keyboard. It's been kind of expensive and kind of more of a gimmick, I guess the word is I want to use, than anything else. So although I've been really curious about it for years, I've never, you know, sprung for it because it's just too expensive for a gimmick. But this year, two things happened, and the most important of which is the price for the base model, which I think is usable for me, for a Windows 10 device, it's $999, $1,000, which to me is right about the point, it's expensive, but, you know, I can think about it. At $1,500, it's like, not really, for something that's a gimmick, especially. And two, I don't think it's a gimmick anymore. And that's because I actually have a use case for it now, whereas previously, it was just like, it might be interesting. And the use case is this, you know, during this pandemic, I've been splitting my time between the office and home. And in the office, I have multiple monitors, you know, that kind of good stuff. And at home, I could do it. I just don't want to because it would feel too much like work. I did buy, I think I mentioned it to you, or, you know, several times already. I bought a USB-C powered portable 15-inch display maybe a year ago. This is pre-pandemic, I bought it. Because it seemed like an interesting idea. But it turned out to be not as portable or convenient as I hoped it would be. Or even works the way I hoped it would work. Like, you know, just one plug to rule them all. One USB cable to rule them all. So that didn't really work out. And what I ended up doing is I have an iPad next to me with its own keyboard, its own physical keyboard, that I take notes on when I'm on video calls. And, you know, so I don't obscure the video call and the notes and the various other things that chat notes that appear when you're in these video calls these days. But I was thinking, you know, if I had something like the Asus Duo, the new one that's only relatively speaking, only $999, then I could take notes on the lower LCD, which is smaller, but it's, you know, big enough for a text notepad. And, you know, do the video conferencing and other stuff on a bigger normal screen. And this just work for other things too, you know, when you're doing research and maybe if you could, you have your spreadsheet or your Word doc or PowerPoint, whatever your main screen and your notes and maybe a web browser and a smaller screen, if it can do that, I think it can, then that would make a lot of sense. And lastly, it's something I learned years ago and I thought about but haven't done anything about is I was at a telehealth conference a couple of years ago. And a pediatric psychiatrist who does a lot of remote telehealth work with children and their parents, because, you know, Hawaii is an island state, so, you know, he'd have to fly or they'd have to fly. It's not convenient. Or, you know, even practicable for some of his clients. So he does a lot of telehealth. And what he told us is really interesting. I think I mentioned to you before. On our normal setup, we have screens side to side, whether it's two or three, they're generally side to side. And as I'm doing right now to John, as I'm moving my head to look at my notes and then I'm coming back to John, what he sees me is shaking my head left to right, right to left, which looks like I'm saying no to him all the time. And he said that's a very bad thing to do, especially with children that he works with. And he said what he does is he has his monitors for teleconferencing set up vertically. So, you know, when he's nodding, looking up, he's giving affirmation. Yes, you know, I'm listening to you. Yes, I'm paying attention to you. And maybe, yes, I'm agreeing with you or I hear you, right? He's not shaking his head left or right all the time, saying no, no, no. And so I thought, well, that's actually kind of handy now because, you know, in the past, John, you're pretty much the only guy I talk to in a video conference. You know, once a week, Sundays, it's John.
Yeah. Right?
But these days, you know, I'm on from 7:30 to whenever, you know, for hours and hours a day. So I thought, well, this might make more sense. I don't know. I'm really thinking about it.
Well, I think it's not a bad thing to try. And I look at the way I have my monitors set up. You know, I've been in two of my three offices. I use Apple 27-inch cinema displays, mm-hmm. which are big enough for everything I ever need. And mm-hmm. I can orient the windows as I want there. I do have another office that has two 27-inch displays side by side, or 24-inch, sorry. So they're big, and they give me more screen real estate, but they're not as useful, I think, as the one big panel that I use. But the thing for me that has gotten me, you know, in the last year that I've really noticed is, for example, on Thursday, I had a 8:30 meeting on Thursday that lasted until 10:30. Then I had a noon meeting that lasted until 1:30. Then yep. I had a 2 o'clock in-person meeting. And then I had a 3:30 meeting that lasted until 4:30.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't take sitting at my desk for that long. And at home and at one of my offices, I have a standing sitting desk cart thing
right.
that basically can go up and down.
Right.
And so I finally broke down and bought this week a monitor riser from the same company for one desk that doesn't have that. Because I like my desk at my psychology office. It's a nice desk. It's got, you know, a bunch of storage, all that. But it doesn't go up and down, and that was the office I was in on Thursday, and I was the guy who was pivoting my monitor all the way up and standing about 10 feet away from my desk so that I could still talk to people but also could stand, because it was just getting way too uncomfortable to sit there for that long. That's the one problem with getting so much more into physical activity this last year with going for regular walks, is that my legs physically get frustrated if I'm sitting too long. And so I have to stand and move around a little more. I think I'm going to unfortunately be that guy when we go back to in-person meetings that gets up and wanders around the room and, you know, stands in the corner and kind of listens to the meeting and chimes in every so often.
Well, just tell folks that you are a great admirer of Steve Jobs. And as you know, Steve Jobs, I don't know how he is in meetings or was in meetings, but, you know, on stage, he would always walk around, right? He was never the type to stand in front of a podium and just speak to the audience. He was always, he had a, you know, wireless mic. He's pointing at the screen. He's making gestures. You know, just tell him that that's, you know, your kind of your presentation hero.
Well, I really should send you the videos of my human factors class, because you would see that. Because in person, I do that quite a bit in my lectures. I don't think I stand near one place very long. So,
you know, we should talk about ergonomics and pandemic work going forward, because, you know, there's been a lot of articles I've read about, you know, the non-ergonomic home office, right, which is kind of obvious. I'm sitting in a kitchen chair right now, which I happen to find very comfortable. But, you know, we've all had to really think about the ergonomics of our home. And, you know, even our offices are rarely ergonomically designed. By the way, can you hear this? I've got the Powerball rolling. But anyway, here, I'll put it near the microphone. Yeah, but far away, I don't think you can hear it. But anyway. And that is that the inactivity of the information worker is a real problem, right? I mean, it's, you know, you're sitting in a chair for hours a day, whether you're at the office or the home. And depending on your office setup and your home setup, you may or may not be able to take a walk or, you know, or even weather, you know, especially if you're at your home, you may have less opportunity to walk outside if your home is small like mine. John showing his wallpaper.
As Todd is talking about this, I have now stood up and I have rotated my desk 270 degrees because it's on wheels, and he can see my Lilo and Stitch print over here that
which
I have.
Which is appropriate since I'm in Hawaii.
Look at. Yes, exactly. That's why I thought you would appreciate it.
But anyway,
it is so. But yeah, talking about ergonomics and the design, that's one of the reasons why I bought this particular you know, movable desk a year ago or 2 years ago was because even before the pandemic, when I was working from home, I wanted to be able to reconfigure my workspace. And all the things that I keep that I need are actually on the base of this, so that when I rotate it around, the whole desk just kind of comes with me.
Oh,
and
neat.
If I had to, I could unplug the thing and take it to another room or things like that. So, but yeah, it's definitely an interesting thing that we've been becoming much more aware of during the pandemic.
Definitely. So I got to tell you, and I'm going to save my nickels and dimes up over the next, I don't know when this is going to be available, but, you know, like I said, this is an advancement on a series. So it's not a brand new product. It's just a product that is now much, much less expensive, you know, and something I can afford, I think. And I think, like I said, I've got a use case for it now, which I didn't really have 12 months ago when its predecessor was released or announced. At a time, I thought, wow, I would really like one of those. They really look interesting, but can I justify it? And I couldn't. And not that I always have to justify everything I buy, but when it approaches a certain dollar amount, it's like, and $1,500 is past that dollar amount I need to justify. I'll take a look at it. So, yeah, let's come back to ergonomics again when he says, especially since John actually teaches human factors as one of his classes. That'd be interesting, I think. All right. The other topic I have before we hit some of John's ideas is something I don't know if John's interested in. I'm kind of curious. It's called the, I might be pronouncing it wrong, but it's the Mudra band, M-U-D-R-A band, M-U-D-R-A. So I'm going to say Mudra? Mudra? I'm not sure. Not sure what language that's in. But it's a Apple Watch replacement band. So it replaces whatever band you've got now. And it's supposed to have touch-free control. I'll give you touch-free control of your Apple Watch. So the way they describe it is you can control music, manage calls, dismiss notification using effortless finger movements. And by finger movements, the fingers on the hand that your watch is on, not touching the watch. Mm-hmm. It's $180 and allegedly available this March. I'm kind of curious because I often don't have both hands free when I've got my watch on. Well, I have my watch on all the time, but we know when I'm doing things. And it'd be kind of handy, like maybe when you're driving and you want to dismiss a notification or something, or control music for that matter. But $180, I've only ever bought one band for my watch. And I used the same third-party band on my 6 that I used on my original Apple Watch Series 3, and it cost $11. So I'm having some justification issues spending $180, but I think if it becomes available in March as it says, I think I will take a close look at the reviews of it. I'm really kind of curious how comfortable it is, because this $11 wristband is really comfortable.
Yeah, I looked at it too before the show, and it's something I've seen prototypes of in the last few years. This has been something that obviously a lot of groups have wanted for the Apple Watch.
Yeah,
I would definitely be interested in looking at it, especially as I do also end up using my watch quite a bit and also have my hands busy sometimes when I'm moving around. It always is that you get that notification at that very moment that your hands are filled with whatever you're doing. So and my nose can only do so much, which I think a lot of Apple Watchers realize just how useful your nose is when there's a call coming in or something that that you really need to take care of.
Yep, the nose becomes an appendage. All right, John, I think you've got a couple of things you want to mention too.
Two CES notes. So CES 2021, I said basically if you aren't into niche technologies, if you're not a big robotics or drone or automation self-driving car person, if those aren't like your real hot areas, the mainstream stuff, what I would think are mainstream things that would appeal to a lot of people, were kind of boring, I thought, this year. There wasn't much that I looked at and went, wow, that's really revolutionary. The two that I did notice that I thought were interesting, but both of them sort of fall short. The one is by TCL. It's called a wearable display. It's basically a pair of sunglasses that, video sunglasses, not anything new that we haven't seen before. But nice resolution, basically, you could make the argument that it'd be a great viewing experience if you're kind of isolated and you just want to watch a movie on your own on a flight or something like that. The problem is it can't be used as a regular pair of glasses. Mm. And if I'm going to buy something like this, I want more augmented heads-up display, kind of like what the fabled Apple glasses are supposed to be if they ever are released. Cool that is still something people care about, because wearables definitely have attracted in the couple of years as people have sort of settled on the Apple Watch and Android Wear. And Google just purchased Fitbit. So, we're going to be seeing some collapsing there too, I would think. So I like to see wearable innovation. But like the Mudra band and this, it's cool to see, but I don't know if it's going to hit the bill or not.
Yeah. Go ahead. I was just going to say, I'm semi-related in terms of it being, something wearing a head, but not AR glasses like the Google glasses or this one. I think Vizio announced a, I don't know if it's an AR or VR headset, but it's supposed to let you see five large displays, you know, floating in front of you. And displays being, you know, your monitors. So, you know, we're just talking about multi-monitor setups. So this one, you just wear your glasses and not Vizio, Vuzio. It's a pretty Vuzix. It's a pretty well-known brand. I remember looking at them like 10, 12 years ago. And I thought that was kind of interesting. The problem is, again, it's, you know, expensive. It's $2,000. And so it's not something I would buy just for, you know, just for fun. And it's probably something I would wait for more development if I wasn't planning on retiring in 2 years.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of a long, you know, long-term purchase. But anyway, sorry, John, go ahead.
Well, and then the second thing that I thought was interesting, purely from what it does, not necessarily its exact use scenario, is so I'll say the whole game because it's one of these. I think they hired someone from Microsoft to make this name. The Ifan Butte Rogue Sir Measure powered by Perso. It is a it's basically a cylinder that custom mixes lipstick shades and. As someone who does not wear lipstick and doesn't actually know a lot of women who have wildly different tastes in lipstick day to day, this is sort of a weird idea that, you know, you would be able to use a color wheel on your smartphone and choose exactly the color you want, and then it will dispense three different pigments to create that exact color, and you kind of move it around with your finger, and then you can apply it to your lips. And okay, so... this is one of those things where I think it's a really cool piece of technology to have that level of customization and flexibility, but I just don't see a lot of people going, you know, gee, my makeup needs to be 2% more red or 3% more cream or this and that. It's just sort of I think it's a cool idea. That was sort of maybe if that can extend, and really it's starting to extend, I think, with other lifestyle things like the ice cream pods that came out this year.
I thought that was interesting. If I could still eat ice cream.
Yeah. So I like these things that are pushing the envelope because I think they're a little bit more interesting than the robotics and the drones and just automation and self-driving cars. Yeah, that's cool stuff and that's stuff I want, but it's not really what I think of as consumer electronics. It's more what I think of as industrial electronics.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the companions thing because, you know, I've been following that for years. And this year, you know, last year, remember that creepy one where it was kind of a tribble with a tail with no head or appendages?
Yep.
That it was creepy but interesting. And then there was the dog who's, you know, the robot dog that I found even more interesting and not creepy at all. This year, there's something called, I think it's the Moflin, M-O-F-L-I-N or something like that. And it is basically looks like a guinea pig or hamster. Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate. Guinea pig or hamster. Kind of like a oblong tribble, really. But it doesn't look creepy like that one from the other year. I don't know what the price is. It's one of those, you know, it's one of those forever coming soon kind of things. But I'm really, you know, as I get older, I'm really interested in these robotic companion things because at some point I'll be too old to raise another pet. And that day's coming soon. And so it'd be kind of nice to have a, you know, a robot pet, I think.
Well, you're talking about the Moflin. The Moflin is on Kickstarter right now.
Yeah.
And if you back it for the pledge amount to get one of these little creatures, is 41,800 yen, or about $400.
Well, that's pretty reasonable.
And its estimated delivery is June 2021.
Okay.
So that is an interesting one. I don't know. Yeah. But you know, it does sound cool. I would definitely think of it as a perfect pet in a sense. I have to see if they says their personalities will be different if you get two of them. So for 77,000 yen, you can get two.
Well, it's supposed to have some kind of AI so that it apparently changes its behavior based on your behavior. So not quite sure what that means, but I found it interesting. So maybe you can get a grant to do some, you know, some research on it. That way you don't have to actually pay for it out of pocket.
Well, what I would rather have is an AI that interacts with me over text. you know, that is that would live completely on device. Yeah, a chatbot, but one that is AI driven, lives completely on device, is not, you know, there's no way for it to be compromised and just, you know, checks in with me every so often and talks to me. And, you know, because, you know, for a lot of text communications I have, it tends to be a pretty one way relationship where either someone's asking, well, it's usually someone's asking something from me and or looking for support and things like that. I tend to be a pretty level headed person. So I think I focus some people's exhaust valve when they're frustrated. And so it'd just be nice to have, like, you know, the AI chatbot ask me how I'm doing, you know.
You want Eliza? A really, really smart Eliza.
Yeah. Yeah. I want a smart Eliza. Not one that, you know, when I say I'm dead, asks me how I like being dead.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing.
How do you feel about being dead?
Yeah, exactly. Which, you know, I actually show a video in Human Factors that features Eliza briefly. There's a video, there's a Nova special from 2012 when Watson was programmed to play Jeopardy.
Oh,
I show that. Which, here's a weird rant about Nova and streaming web video. I don't know if I've ever told this.
No.
You know, Nova is published by PBS, Public Broadcasting in the United States. It is taxpayer supported. But if you want to buy a DVD to show in your class or something like that, then they do ask for a small donation for the DVD.
Okay.
So back when this broadcast in 2012, it was on streaming on PBS's website for a year before they took it off and put it in the archives. So that's when I showed it to one class. It worked out really well. And I ended up using some web downloading software that, you know, you could legally buy to save the stream, basically, for myself. And then about 3 years later, I was looking at our library holdings, and I noticed that our campus library had a copy of the Nova special.
Yeah.
I thought, great, it's on DVD. It should be better quality than my web stream, so I will go grab it.
Right.
So I get the DVD. I take a look at the DVD. So this whole show talks about how Watson was programmed to play Jeopardy, and then the last 20 minutes walks through the games, and there's a lot of suspense about what's going to happen. Is Watson going to win? Is he not going to win? All that. In the streaming video, which was released on streaming after Jeopardy aired their episodes, it tells you what happened. You know, it's got this is the play-by-play. In the DVD, which was produced and put out before Jeopardy showed their episodes, it literally gets the last 2 minutes and goes, well, watch on September 23rd.
Oh, wow.
See what happens. And I thought, wow, that is the worst way to take care of someone who actually bought your product versus someone who downloaded it off the web. So, if you've ever been watching that DVD and you don't know how it happened, let me know and I can find a way to stream you the last 2 minutes so that you can see how it the special actually ended.
Yeah, they should at least have a URL that says, if you want to learn what happened, you know, go to this URL and we'll tell you the outcome, you know, or something.
I mean, it was 8 years ago now, so I think most people can easily figure out what happened, but still, it was a very, very strange thing. I remember coming across that. Speaking of strange, I have a support interaction that was very strange from the last week.
Okay.
So back in, I guess, June or so, I bought a Zendura power bank super tank, which is basically a very large external battery. It's 27,000 milliamp hour. It can run my MacBook Pro. It can run anything. It's got, you know, 100-watt USB-C output on it and a 60-watt USB-C and then a couple of USB-As. So I have not been traveling much. This might surprise you, but I do take it out every so often and charge it up, make sure it's still working, all that, because that my whole plan was for it to eventually go on trips with me. And when I took it out in the beginning of this year, in January, I found that it was dead. I couldn't get it to power up. It didn't have any, you know, nothing was working. So I contacted Zendura support. And I said, look, you've got a 1-year warranty on this thing. It seems dead to me. What should I do? They had me shoot a video where I showed them that it was dead, which I thought was a little bit excessive, but whatever. You know, I had to show them, look, I'm plugging it in here. Nothing's happening. Hitting this button. Nothing's happening. Trying different cords. Nothing's happening. I can plug this other cord into the USB-C device. You can see it's giving it power, but whatever. So then they finally agreed that they would replace it, and they asked me for the serial number. So I then took a look at the device and went, huh, there's a label on it, but there's no serial number. I wonder where the serial number is. And as I looked, and I put the pictures in the show notes for Todd to take a look at.
I'm looking at it.
It has grooved ridges, and you think, well, there's nothing there. And if you shine a light between the two long screws, you see a serial number. And that serial number, I kid you not, has ha ha in it. H-A-H-A is part of the serial number. And oh, I can only imagine that they... You know, they really enjoyed putting that serial number there. It is the most user-unfriendly place I've ever seen for a serial number. But they did accept the warranty replacement and sent me out a new unit within a couple of days. So I now have a working one of these again. So I have to give them props. Their support worked well. But, man, if you hate your users, that's where you put their serial number, where I had to use a little flashlight just to read the serial number.
Yeah, and John sent me a photo of with the light on and without a flashlight on, but in the light, and then in a normally the room lighted situation with light, and he's right, it's invisible without a flashlight on. At least you didn't need like a UV light to, you know, make it glow in the dark or something.
Well, the nice thing was I had been carrying around, so at Christmas I got a new light. That I had put on my wish list. I'll actually, I think I mentioned it in one of our previous episodes where we talked about what cool things we had gotten. But it is a Nightcore TUP flashlight, and it has a crazy amount of light to it that it can put out. And I have been wearing that on my belt because it's got a nice belt clip on it. And in the last 3 weeks... Two times I've been saved by it, by just having it there and being able to use it. So one time was this, where I didn't have to go finding how to get this serial number.
Right.
And the other time I was teaching a class last Tuesday and found out that one of the cables inside the instructor podium had died, and I had to figure out where it was being fed from and everything else and fix it. And so the light came in handy then. So if you don't carry a flashlight, sometimes it really is helpful to have one.
You know, and I got to tell you, I don't have one quite as handy as yours, but I do have this. It's not something you would put on your belt. Well, I guess you could, but it has, I bought this a couple of years ago because I'm constantly either needing a flashlight, you know, to look in some nook and cranny or something, or look for something. And I'm also constantly in need of a little tiny knife to, you know, open boxes, basically in Amazon boxes or something else. And so this flashlight, which looks like a normal half-size flashlight, it's pretty bright, so it's great as a flashlight. It also has a window, I don't know what you would call it, a window cracker. So, you know, in an emergency, you can literally crack open a window with this little tool. And it's got a couple of cutting devices, regular knife, and like a can opener. Anyway, it wasn't too expensive. I think it was like $12, and it's just super, super handy. I can't imagine. So I just keep it right in front of me because I'm always using it. Yeah, we should have another episode just on like inexpensive gadgets we've bought over the years, because you've turned me on to a couple, including that carbiner that lets you hang stuff on a table. That's been super handy.
Yeah, it would be interesting to do an episode like that on, did we use them as much as we thought or did we not?
Yeah, because there are some things I bought that's like, never really used it. But
yeah.
Okie dokie. Well, that's all I've got, John.
Yeah, I'm good too, so. Alrighty. We're back after hiatus, and I assume maybe next week we'll have more to talk about.
Yep. So, Movies Mobile Views Podcast 347. You know, I just realized the other problem with going left to right using two screens now. I've been using a sidecar on my iPad with John lately to keep my notes in one screen and him on the main screen. Is I'm moving my head left to right, so not only am I telling him no all the time, but giving him negative affirmation. But my voice is probably also shifting from loud to soft as I turn my voice and talk. I would turn my head and talk. Maybe I should use my lavalier that I use for video conferencing. But at any rate, we'll talk to you next time.